Welcome to Local Talk, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with
Susan Franzen. Thank you for joining us. This week began with the startling news that the Army Corps of Engineers put a halt, for the time being, to construction of the Bakken Pipeline, as they were preparing to build the pipeline through the area of the Missouri River just north of the Standing Rock Indian Reservation.
Regardless of what you may think of this decision, there is no denying that these events are directly connected with our lives here in Central Iowa. And today we bring you some voices of people in the area who can contribute deeper perspectives.
We start our story today at Pilot Mound, a town in Boone County that recently had its own pipeline news story. The pipeline was laid under the Des Moines River last week, 2.5 miles from Pilot Mound. I traveled there last Sunday to hear firsthand how the town is affected.
I'm Lita Burton, and I'm the mayor of Pilot Mound.
I'm Jeff Lass. I'm retired from Fairway Warehouse in Boone, and I'm a resident of Pilot Mound. Lived here all my life.
Originally, when we got involved, was back when the IUB, Iowa Utilities Board, hadn't even made the decision, and they were sending out packets, or I suppose they weren't even sending out packets. It was, hey, respond if you have a problem with this. So we responded to that saying, hey, we're really concerned about where this pipeline is going and how close is this going to be to our well, because we're one of the few communities that actually still has our own well system, our own water utility, and we don't want that compromised in any way. So that's kind of how we originally kind of got involved. And then on top of that, we had several farmers that are within our community that were being affected by this eminent domain, which was also, I mean, when it affects our farmers and it affects our people in our community, then it's important to us because we are a small community. So those things are really important to us. You know, just very concerned about what a spill could do to affect our small community, because at this point we're pretty good, pretty well off, self-sufficient, not really having to depend on big utilities and big water companies and those types of things. So that's kind of how we entered the beginning of that. And then we didn't really get too involved till a decision was made. And then all the folks that were, you know, opposing this kind of approached and said, hey, you know, like many people in this county, I was completely ignorant to everything that was going on. I don't think that it was really out there. And the only people who were really playing out there obviously would be the people who were opposed to it, not the people who were for it. So we still hadn't gotten any response in our concerns about how could this affect us. Like, if it wasn't going to affect us, the least that could have been done is somebody could have said, hey, here's what's going on. This is where it's going to be. This is what protections maybe you need to take. This is some things that you don't have to worry about. You know, nobody tried to ease our minds. Nobody addressed it. I feel like our paper was just put on the bottom of a pile. And, you know, when you think about small communities, who's really concerned about them other than the people who live there? And I talked to the council and said, how do you guys feel about this? And they were really not for the eminent domain issue that was there. Hey, that's really not fair and should be addressed. And then, hey, how's this really going to affect our folks here that live here in this city? So
yeah, and I was concerned, come up to one of their meetings that day that they had it up here on a Saturday, I think it was, and I was concerned about our shallow water well out there on the highway. It's only 20 foot deep, and if there was a leak doesn't have to bubble up to the top. It can hit a aquifer and go into our water system without coming up and affect everybody, as far as I was concerned about. Or when they were digging in the pipeline out there, if they would dig down far enough, if they would have hit our aquifer, if it would divert it and not come into our well. That was one of my concerns out there, since we have a shallow water well out there. That was my concern.
I understand that they tried 3 times to get under the Des Moines River and then finally did. Are you concerned with where they did it and how they did it?
Yes, I am, because if they done 3 times, dug down underneath there, there's got to be an opening down there, and it should be, if that pipe isn't laying on a solid ground, or if it's laying on a swamp bed down there, it could shift and break right underneath the river, you know. If they tried 3 times, there's got to be sludge and stuff brought back up because they're boring it down through there. They're bringing dirt back out as they're boring it and putting the pipe in. You know, they've made it the ground weaker, as far as I'm concerned, if they tried three times to get it in there. The support for the pipe isn't down there any longer.
And you, do you have any recourse to demand that they... I don't know what they can do.
I don't either.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, and we have just heard a recording of an interview with Leda Burton, mayor of Pilot Mound, and Jeff Lass, a concerned resident of Pilot Mound.
One of many stories and communities that have been affected by the Bakken Pipeline. Last week, KHOI received an unusual visit related to the Bakken Pipeline. Yvonne Scott is someone who is actually driving the entire length of the pipeline route in order to visit and see the many communities that are affected by the pipeline and to witness the impact it's having on the environment. Yvonne Scott is originally a Midwesterner and has a special interest in this area. She also had another unusual and special reason to stop in Ames. In order to make this trip, she needed a map, and as it turns out, the only map she was able to find that helped her make the trip was produced right here in Ames, Iowa. But I'll let her tell the story.
I'm going to Standing Rock to drop off supplies, but weather permitting, I'm hoping to go as close to the Bakken oil fields as I can. Ames is about the halfway point of the Dakota Access Pipeline that stretches from Patoka, Illinois, up to the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota. I'm driving along the path of the pipeline, and so as I'm following this long red line, Ames is one of the stopping points.
Where did you come from?
I live in Tuckasegee, North Carolina, in the Great Smoky Mountains. It was 8 hours from where I lived to Patoka, Illinois, to just begin.
So you came from the east, and you connected there, and now you're following the pipeline up to
North Dakota.
You are an individual who's acting on your own, just
yes.
Because something matters to you.
Yes. We collected donations from the town that I live in, and they had to get there somehow. And so an adjunct to that was, well, maybe I can tie these two things together. Maybe I can be of service by somehow connecting all the people along this pipeline, because it's not just the Standing Rock Sioux. They have certainly elevated this cause and made many, many thousands and millions of people more aware. But I also wanted to look at the farmland, the little towns along the way. And so I got this idea on the spur of the moment. I said, well, maybe I should just look at this land and go all the way back to the source of the oil, and maybe I can give people an idea of what we will lose. Searching for a map, I did a Google search for DAPL, Dakota Access Pipeline maps. There were none. It's not clear where the pipeline actually will be from the information that's given out publicly by the Dakota Access Pipeline conglomerate. I had to search a lot to find Nitin's Bakken oil pipeline map. It's the only map that actually clearly distinguishes where exactly this pipeline is crossing. I mean, you can get down to the square foot and find out where it is. And when I saw Nitin's map and I realized where this oil from the Bakken oil fields was actually going to end up, it hit me. I was suddenly alarmed. I said, that's beautiful country. That's farmland. I knew that area.
It meant something to you personally.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm a product of the Midwest. I grew up in central Illinois. I've been to Patoka, Illinois, because I know this area. It just overwhelmed me. I know there are thousands of miles of pipeline already in the ground, but coming from the Midwest, this was sensitive to me.
And so you're using this map as you drive.
Yeah. This one is interactive. So just like you do a Google map, my location shows up on my phone to tell me where I am and how close I am to the pipeline so that I could get off of a road, a main road, and divert along a country road and actually see the pipeline either where it might be completed or under construction.
So the map is accurate?
It's impossible to just drive the pipeline. I mean, you have to understand this in backyards, it's in farmland, that's down gullies, and it's not as easy to access as possible. When I'm in front of a point and I check it on Nitin's map, and I realize it's very accurate, I try to take a picture. We're doing some geotagging now from now on. He's helped me learn how to do that.
But what is geotagging?
Geotagging is to stand at a point. You can take a picture, and it will register the exact location, longitude, latitude, take a picture of it, and it'll plot it on a map for other people to see.
So are you providing photographs for the website?
I am. I'm doing photos. I have a small blog I put out just as a day-by-day documentary explaining some of the reasons why I'm going and what I'm seeing and sharing photos. Just to let people know that this pipeline is more than just the crossing of the Missouri River, which is very important.
And where is the blog?
My blog is called healtheheartland.blogspot.com. healtheheartland.blogspot.com.
To photograph the pipeline, can you get close enough to these sites?
I haven't had any problems where I have been. Last night, I was outside Keokuk, Iowa, at the point on Nitton's map where the crossing of the Mississippi should take place. I wanted to see if they were boring a big hole in the ground. I have no idea how this works.
So what did you see?
Engineering. I saw a man in a truck parked by the side of the road and a sign on the other side of the road going up a large bluff that said access road for the pipeline. There was just a notice that said caution pipeline construction ahead, but no activity. So I think it's still in process. So what I'm learning is while I think the information we get is this pipeline's a done deal, actually it's not. There's large sections of it that are not finished, that they are working on, but it's not finished by any means.
Where in Illinois does the pipeline end?
Patoka.
Patoka, Illinois. That's the destination for this pipeline. You started there with this map. What does that look like right now?
Patoka, Illinois is a very tiny, it's a spit in the road. On Google Earth, you can see what locals call tank farms, acres and acres of these huge round white tanks. They're storage tanks. What I learned from being there and talking to people is that Patoka is the intersection of three pipelines. There's already a pipeline coming from Canada into Patoka. The Dakota Access will run into Patoka, and then another pipeline already is the discharge pipeline that goes down to Lake Charles, Louisiana. So this little teeny tiny town, which it's just a farm community, has become the hub of all this energy.
Now this is on a river?
No, it's inland. It's inland. It's not near a railroad line.
How does the oil get?
Pipeline.
But the pipeline ends in Patoka.
No, the pipeline discharges into Patoka from those tanks. It's then discharged and goes down to Lake Charles, Louisiana. It's all underground. It's all there already.
A different pipeline?
Yeah.
So the Bakken pipeline meets up with a different pipeline. It's like a tributary into another pipeline.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a good metaphor.
So the destination of Patoka is because there's a pipeline there that can be used to take it down to the Gulf of Mexico.
It's already there, yeah.
This town, has it grown around this issue or there's...
You would not know from what you see that there's any kind of prosperity. It's interesting. People in Illinois seem to have a complacency about this. It's like, oh, yeah, it's a pipeline. You know, yeah, there's lots of people working. I stopped at a cafe in Meridosha, and, waitresses are great. They know everything. And I just asked her, you know, I said, well, there's a lot of activity around here. And she said, oh, yeah. She said, we got the pipeline. We got a cable being laid and putting in a new bridge. And then she looked me square in the face, and she said, that's good now, but when they go, so's business gone. I don't think we realize how few permanent jobs come out of this, and yet the ecological damage is massive, the potential for it. The trade-off is not a good one. One place that was most difficult for me was yesterday. I was driving the pipeline road to Meridosha, which is on the Illinois River, on the Illinois side of the river, and there will be a crossing near there. I was not allowed access there. You just can't drive there. But I could see where a lot of work was being done. And you have to understand that for hundreds of years, before they put the levee in along the Illinois River, that was a floodplain. That is enormously rich alluvial soil. It's some of the finest soil, you know, in that part of Illinois. And when you see that they have rows of these earth-moving equipment, I put a picture on my blog. I didn't count them, but there are at least a dozen of these enormous earth-moving equipment pieces parked. And you say that's going to rip up that soil. That's what they're there for, is to rip up that soil and move over it back and forth, and compact it. There's gravel roads that they've built that they've had to gravel to get this equipment down. Where does that rock go if they don't remove it? And it's just a destruction, I think, of just the land. It's painful. It's really painful for me to watch.
So I'm speaking with Yvonne Scott, who is one individual from North Carolina who's decided to drive from North Carolina to Standing Rock in North Dakota and to drive along the pipeline to actually see it and document it. Yvonne is using a map made by Nitin Gaudia, who is a local resident of Ames, Iowa,
yeah,
who decided to make a map of the Bakken Pipeline and research the information and is providing you with an interactive map that allows you to follow the pipeline as you drive along the back roads.
Right.
So what do you think of Nitin's map?
It's extraordinary. I wouldn't have done this without that map. If I hadn't found that map, I would have come the way everybody else does, just take the interstates and get there the fastest
way. Now, you've met Nitin. What do you make of somebody who just makes a map of the Bakken Pipeline?
He has an understanding of how powerful a map is, and we often don't give that enough credence. A map is a lot of power. And he also sees it as public domain. We have a right to that information.
Mm-hmm.
And he's committed to that. And I'm deeply appreciative of it. If a map was insignificant, then the Dakota Access Pipeline people would have given us a map, wouldn't they? Made it as clear as Nitin's map is to me. Why didn't they?
So I wanted to ask you what you make of it. I mean, this was a journey you decided to take. What do you make of it so far? What does this mean to you?
I think I'm sadder than I was when I started, because of the landscape that I've driven through. To look at the beauty of where we live in the Midwest, to know the importance of this area as the breadbasket of the world, the wildlife, the tributaries, the waterways that I've crossed, the little creeks and streams that all flow together and end up in the Des Moines River or the Skunk River or finally into the Mississippi. And I think of the potential is so enormous.
So why are you sad?
Because I don't know how to reach people who don't understand that.
You mean the potential for what is enormous?
The potential for an environmental, I don't want to just call it disaster. I mean, an ecological, irrevocable change.
And that's what makes you sad.
That's what makes me sad. And it also is what empowers me. Maybe in this journey, I thought I'd find a way to talk to people.
Are you finding that?
Bit by bit.
What would you say?
Come with me. See what I see. Yeah, I think of people. If people could see the miracle that we live on and really understand how we are connected. The natives say it, we're all related, we're all relatives. And we've lost that somehow. But I think when you're off the interstate and you're far away and all you hear are birds and wind, it speaks to you. For me, it says, this is home. And this is our home. It also says to me, the other day when I was driving, I stopped at a place, a little lake, and I looked up. And there was a bald eagle circling above me. And I watched this bald eagle. We don't really have a connection with our planet anymore. So I think if I could entice other people to do sections of this, to take it upon themselves just to go out their back door, you know, go outside Ames, go walk a couple of miles of the pipeline with Nitin's map. It's easy now. You know, you can't get lost because you're a little blue dot on a map. And put your feet on that earth and look at it and imagine what it would be like if it was no longer alive, if it was no longer healthy. just to stand there and feel that, maybe that would make a difference.
Thank you so much.
Thank
really
you,
appreciate it.
Ursula. It's a pleasure.
Tell us again your blog.
healtheheartland.blogspot.com.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. You have been listening to an interview with Yvonne Scott as she was traveling through Ames. She is a resident of North Carolina who recently made it her personal mission to drive along the entire route of the Bakken Pipeline as she was headed to Standing Rock to deliver supplies that had been collected in her hometown. I am Susan Franzen, one of your hosts for today, together with Ursula Rudenberg. As you listen to these stories, please consider how we are able to bring you such in-depth information and act people's hearts and minds. KHOI is non-commercial and independent community radio, which gives us the freedom to build community, understanding, and connection. In order to do so, we depend on your support to fund community radio. Please join Community Radio by going to khoifm.org and donating to become a member sponsor. The website is khoifm.org. Our goal is $25,000 to earn a matching grant offered to the station. We are currently at $21,000 and ask you to go to our website now, khoifm.org, to help us meet our goal. Thank you.
And we are hearing from people in the area who offer personal insights and professional perspectives on the Bakken Pipeline, a national story, but our own local community story as well. After hearing Yvonne's story, I asked Nitin Gadia, creator of the map she was using, to describe this extraordinary project. Nitin is a resident of Ames and a map maker by profession.
In the first several months of this year, I got wind of the pipeline. There were a lot of signs that started popping up in and out of town. There was a huge sign outside of town that said, stop eminent domain abuse. And so I heard about it and I was kind of immediately sympathetic towards it. I mean, eminent domain being used for a pipeline company basically just making its own private profit, it sounded insane to me. About 3 months ago, a friend of mine told me that she was planning on getting arrested at a demonstration against the pipeline. She told me that I was welcome to come, and I did.
And this was down by the Des Moines River outside of Ames?
Yeah. And I watched as these people basically stood in the way of construction, and 30 people got arrested. Honestly, I felt a little bit out of place at the protest because people were there mostly about environmental issues, and I didn't really have enough background in that. I was sympathetic towards the cause, but it was more on the eminent domain side of things. I wasn't as connected to this issue. But, you know, the two friends that I have that got arrested, they're very well informed, and I knew that there had to be something behind it. So in the following weeks, I started researching the pipeline a little bit, just looking into it, just reading stuff online, and pretty quickly I realized that there's not a map of the pipeline, which is crazy. So I was just like, oh, well, I guess I'm going to have to make a map of this pipeline.
And recently the New York Times used your map to make their own map of the Bakken Pipeline?
Yeah, you know, I got a call from a reporter at the New York Times, and she, we talked through all the details about the map, and eventually she used it and credited me in Map Story, and that was cool.
How did you go about making the map?
What I found out pretty quickly was that Dakota Access basically prevented each state from releasing digital data of the pipeline, but they gave them maps. Each of the states required them to give them physical maps. I had to dig around and find all the maps, and there were hundreds and hundreds of them. They were in PDFs, electronic hard copies. And I put it all together in a document, and I posted it online on a website, and I hired two people, one person in the Philippines and one person in Kenya. They spent about 60, 70 hours putting these maps, like hundreds and hundreds of maps, over the surface, and they drew over it. Georeferencing is where you take a map, you would scan it, you lay it over a digital surface.
So that's what these people that you hired did?
Yep. They took hundreds of maps and georeferenced them. And about a week later, I had a complete map of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
And how precise is it?
It's very precise. It's probably within a few feet. Well, you can probably walk up to it and it'll be the same. So,
how is the map interactive?
You can zoom in, zoom out. You can see things really up close. It shows your location as a dot on the map. Wherever you are, your computer or your smartphone, it shows you on the map. It uses GPS.
You have described what you were doing as a data call to arms or an act of civil disobedience.
Maps are very, very political.
How does mapping what they're doing constitute an act of civil disobedience?
They don't want the map to be available. They don't want to know where this pipeline is. It's questionable in many cases whether mapping things like this is legal. And I think that people should do it and make it available to people. If these things affect things like people's drinking water or their air or their soil or the most basic things that we depend upon, I think that people should know where they are. I think that's pretty fundamental. People want to keep data secret, and I don't think that in many cases that's legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
I heard another quote. It was like, from data comes information, and from information comes knowledge. Knowledge is used for wisdom, to wisely guide our decisions in the future. If you don't know the pipeline network, you don't know where your energy comes from, how it's delivered, how it's distributed. If you overlaid a pipeline map over the Middle East, I'm sure you can basically determine how those countries are divided by colonial powers. I mean, it's a very, it means a lot to be able to map something.
Let's talk about who you are. You're a resident of Ames, Iowa?
Yeah, I grew up here.
About how old are you?
32.
And you're a map maker by profession?
Well, I've always been into maps. Eventually, I found the Map Story Foundation, and I joined them in the very beginning. It's in development. It's like the Wikimedia Foundation. Basically, anybody will be able to edit and create a map on this website, mapstory.org.
Like Wikipedia, except a map version of it?
Yeah.
What do you do with Map Story?
I develop content. I make maps for Map Story so that when the website is functional, there'll be plenty of content there that's credible and people will be drawn to.
Do you think that the map that you made is important?
Of the Bakken pipeline? Absolutely, yeah.
Why do you think it's important?
People need to know where this pipeline is in great detail. A couple of weeks after I finished the Dakota Access Pipeline map, I made a dedicated site to it, bakkenpipelinemap.com. I mean, I had somebody come up to me in Ames who said, you know, I saw your map and I didn't know it was so close to my house, you know. And you can literally walk up to the pipeline with this map and kind of know where it is, you know.
Now that you finished the Bakken pipeline map, what other maps are you interested in doing?
People around the world, mapping all of the world's energy infrastructure and the history of it. This one would be called Map Story Energy, which could be a very, very powerful thing. Just seeing how the world's energy works and the politics behind it. See, this is the thing. There's this whole network out there of people that map things through crowdsourcing. A classic example is after the Haiti earthquake, Haiti didn't have a digital map of the country, and some company released satellite imagery of Haiti. So basically, all these volunteers from around the world within 3 or 4 days mapped the entire country, and on the ground, people mapped the relief effort. And if you don't have a map for something like a relief effort, that is essential. And that was the map that they used for the relief effort. In the same way, we need to set up an infrastructure for mapping energy, and in the future, we should set up something where from the very beginning, all these pipelines will be mapped regardless of whether the data is available. I made a video of all of the oil spills from pipelines in the United States. They show up on the map as dots over the last 30 years, so it's like a time-lapse animation. And believe it or not, over the last 30 years, there have been about like 8,000 to 9,000 oil spills from pipelines. Very, very often there are pipeline spills that are thousands of barrels.
What would you say is the scale of danger from oil leaks and spills?
I mean, what I found was that the threat is real. Over the last 30 years, if you add up all the oil spills from pipelines, it wouldn't be that much smaller than the BP oil spill down in the Gulf of Mexico.
This is Local Talk. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and we're listening to an interview that I recorded with Nitin Gadia, who is a local resident of Ames, Iowa, and a map maker who made a map of the entire route of the Bakken pipeline, which has become nationally significant. When Nitin started this project, he had personal questions about the issues surrounding the pipeline. One of the issues that came into focus for him was that of Indian Territory and Native American sacred sites.
Weeks after I made this map, I saw somebody posted on Facebook another map focusing on Standing Rock and the pipeline around Standing Rock. It mapped the areas that were the sacred sites that were demolished. It showed the area that was bulldozed. When I hear about people digging up burial sites or when I hear about disputed land from Native Americans, the first thing that I had kind of thought was, well, I mean, all of the United States originally belonged to them. Like, I mean, we can't give it all back. But the thing is that that was a really naive assumption that I had because, yes, Native Americans have been wronged in the past, but they're continuing to be wronged in the present. And what's going on with the Dakota Access Pipeline is it goes deep into the history of the Lakota and Native Americans in general. And you have to take the significance of places to people into account. These people live here today, and these are their ancestors, just like we all have graveyards of our ancestors and relatives. Even in our, you know, so-called secular society, we have things that are sacred to us, like the Statue of Liberty or the Bald Eagle.
How do you think MAFS will help with something like this?
They actually had an archaeological survey conducted along the entire pipeline route. And it's what's crazy about it, though, is that Dakota Access is the one who pays for it, and the report is delivered to them, and they are the ones who give the report back to the government. There's no, like, third-party monitoring, really. I mean, they could be honest, but it's a really fundamentally flawed process, and that data is also not made available to the public. I would like to help initiate something that would map the history of Native Americans. I think that we should put these Indian reservations on maps at the same level maybe that we put states, and we're all in it together. I mean, you know, I feel like, you know, this whole eminent domain thing, the way we regard land is really like a commodity. That doesn't reflect its value to people. To a lot of people, their land is more important to them. That's, you know, in their family, their past, their culture, their heritage, you know. There are people who die for their land. I mean, the Lakota, plenty of Lakota have died for their land repeatedly. And I think everyone in every culture has. And one thing that people often say is, you know, we took their land. I personally think that people need to stop saying we. We need to stop saying, like, people need to stop saying us and them. Because we're all American. I mean, you know, Native Americans are also American. This is about living in dignity with each other, that we are capable of living in mutual... Sorry, I'm getting emotional, you know. It's about... it's this pipeline... Sorry. It just made me cry, you know. And I hope that what this pipeline has shown is that we all share the... Sorry. I hope that what this pipeline has shown us is that we all share this land together, and we all could have from the very beginning, and we can going forward. We just need to, like, sit down and figure it out. When we do that, we can finally live in dignity with one another.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and today we are hearing from individuals in our community with unique perspectives on the Bakken Pipeline. Nitin Gadia is a resident of Ames who created a map of the Bakken Pipeline that has gained national relevance and attention. He is currently working on maps on oil spills and of sacred Native sites, interests that he discovered while mapping the pipeline. In order to gain a better understanding of American Indian sacred sites, an issue raised by the pipeline, we asked David Gradwall, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology and Founding Director of the ISU Archaeological Lab.
Obviously, sacred sites are things like churches and temples and places of worship. One problem with Native American sites in the prairies and plains, there are ritual sites that may or may not be marked by material culture, and that's what we as archaeologists have to go by. They talk about Mother Earth, and they mean it in an existential and connective way that I think we don't when we use that phrase. So there may be stones or areas where Native Americans in the prairies and plains have left tobacco offerings to the creator or other spirits. Or there may be other kinds of sites. One situation that came up at the Meskwaki settlement here in Iowa, a friend of mine at the Meskwaki settlement was very concerned when a road project was going in through the settlement, and he said it was going to impinge on his crying station that would be used in expressing grief when people have died, those sorts of things. I kept asking him, how do you define the perimeters of your crying station? So these make it a little tricky if these areas aren't marked in a way that we normally describe archaeological sites.
What do you say to the natural thought that comes to mind of the land just belongs to other people now? How can you possibly protect all these places on private land as well as public land? How do you go back and protect the former culture?
Well, it was done right here in Ames, right here in River City up at Northridge when that burial mound was discovered, and that was on land that the developers here in Ames were undertaking to build homes that are out on big lots, some of them very nice, but Northridge. This was in 1991. It had been purchased to build a house for a man in town. There was a survey done up there, and archaeologists found it.
How did they know to be there?
Well, first of all, we knew of a very large camp or habitation site that was in an adjacent field on private land where the owners had allowed us from Iowa State University Archaeological Laboratory to go in and look, and we found an indication that there was a habitation site.
So there was already an awareness that there might be?
Well, there was a mound, and then the question is it a glacial mound naturally occurring, or is it something that humans built? And you can test that by putting down a soil probe, and this was not a natural soil development. Additional soil probes were put in, and one of them brought up an identifiable piece of human bone.
It's a burial site.
Yes.
So what happened?
The state archaeologist, according to the Iowa Burial Code, ruled that there could not be any disturbance of the mound. The developers had suggested that we, quote, move the mound down to Moore Park. Well, you can't move a mound like you move a building. And there was some irritation on their part, and I understand it from their economic corporate point of view. But I noticed that none of the developers here in town are putting houses down on their family grave sites in the Ames Municipal Cemetery, which I would argue is sacred to our culture.
What happened to the property?
The realtor said to the state archaeologist and to the state, if we can't build, then you need to pay us for that house lot, which was, I don't know, $40,000 or $50,000, I don't know exactly, but it was pretty pricey. So this went up to the higher courts, which held that that was a pre-existing covenant, that they had to preserve the mound according to our laws, and that was just one of the risks that you take over when you buy a piece of land. Certainly if archaeologists here in Iowa and across the country had to pay back for every site that couldn't be built on, it would bankrupt them, bankrupt states. It was really a landmark case, and we were all watching it. And it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
This piece of land here in Ames.
Yes. It went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they upheld essentially the lower court in not taking it on their docket. And the decision that was made in that case, as far as I know, is that three adjoining landowners to that particular piece of property bought parcels of the land as part of their yards, but they're not allowed to build on it, on top of the mound.
So the yard still remains as a private piece of property, but it can't be changed in any way.
That is right. It can't be built on legally.
It's almost like a historic landmark status.
I thought it was, and it would have been my preference, personally, to have the site as a historic site that people could go to, ask them not to walk on top of the mound, but to explain to them, you know, what this mound was and what its significance was. But Maria Pearson, Indian activist, felt that she did not want people to just, you know, walk on that site and be walking around.
So the site today is not publicly accessible?
No.
The story of the burial site that was dug up in North Dakota with the dogs, that whole story, it's a strange story. As an archaeologist, what did you make of that?
I would want to see the evidence or on what basis did they say there were burials there. I simply can take it that there were burials that were dug up, and it would not surprise me because I think the Bakken Pipeline people have been very sneaky and proceeded with, shall we say, a lack of good faith. That is my personal opinion.
Since I spoke with Nitin, the Obama administration has ruled through the Army Corps of Engineers that they can't build under Lake Oahe without an environmental impact study. How do you respond to those news?
As an archaeologist and as a human being, I was delighted because I think there are environmental impacts. If there's an oil spill, it's going to impact all of our drinking water downstream. So they didn't put it, in a certain place above Bismarck because the good white folks in Bismarck didn't want their water polluted. So in my opinion, they said, let's just pollute it farther down the river. The Corps of Engineers is under a lot of political pressure. I think that they will either put it through there or move it to a different place. And I don't think the situation looks good for the Standing Rock people. I think they're going to be trampled again in the name of corporate greed. We have the problem here in Iowa. I think that there are state administrations that care only about corporate interests. They are not interested in the environment. All they want to do is extract everything they can from the earth and not look into alternative sources. Obviously, I have very strong feelings about this, and part of them are personal in terms of my attitude on the kind of society I would like to live in, and part of them are based on my professional experience. I've been doing this sort of work for over 60 years.
You have had experience with the Army Corps of Engineers and
yes,
how
I have.
They approach the issue of the sacred sites.
I haven't had any particular problem with the Corps of Engineers here in Iowa, in Sailorville and Red Rock Reservoirs. But I do know here in Iowa, and this is what makes me suspicious of what's going on in Dakota, and this is my personal opinion, I saw some of the reports that outside archaeologists came in and did here for the Corps of Engineers, and frankly, they were inadequate. They were not up to the professional standards that we require here in Iowa. And this is just not my opinion. It was opinion expressed by certain individuals at the Office of the State Archaeologist and the State Historic Preservation Office. And there wasn't a requirement by the Corps that they investigate the whole pipeline. There were just certain segments where it went into or under waterways. And that's fine, but it's not adequate because there are sites on the headlands above rivers and streams. You know, I don't like to say these things, but that is my opinion, shared by others. And the Corps of Engineers has done marvelous work over the years. I mean, they built bridges and landing areas when we've been in war and so forth. But after World War II, you have this huge bureaucracy. What are you going to do with them? So you bring them back here to the U.S. and you build reservoirs to keep them in business. I'm all for the development of local recreation. We have some terrific places around Iowa. But we found some and reported some sites down at Elk Rock State Park near Knoxville. The Corps of Engineers asked us to do a survey in terms of where they were going to put in camping sites and toilet facilities and so forth as a state park. And we went down there, and there were sites on almost every upland elevation where they were going to put their camping site. So I said, we will survey the whole park, not just the areas that are going to be developed. And we reported these sites, and the Corps of Engineers wanted us to delete them, or where I'd say a certain site will be destroyed, they wanted me to say might be endangered, and I refused to do so. And I was told by a Corps individual within earshot of my students, don't bite the hand that feeds you. Now, in North Dakota, I haven't seen the site report, so I can't comment on them. But I think there may have been a situation where certain archaeologists did not want to see the evidence or didn't look for evidence where there might have been certain stone alignments or even graves. And in order to do a proper survey. You've got to look at archival records as to where sites have been located. And you need to talk to Native Americans ahead of time and hopefully without any agendas, but just try to find out where these sites are. So you can ask them, you know, where are your sacred sites? Where are there burials that we might encounter? Are there other things that we should be looking for? These are the kinds of standards and ethical procedures that we expect of professional archaeologists today.
As somebody who has spent a great deal of time dealing with sacred sites in your profession, what do you think the benefit to us as human beings, as land is developed on this continent, that we build it in a way so that these sites are integrated into and protected and not destroyed? What is the human benefit to that?
I would like to think that human beings would respect each other, that we, particularly in the United States, claiming to be a democracy and a land of freedom, would learn to live together, people of different races, people of different religions, people of different national origins, and that we would celebrate that diversity. All of these people are, and even ourselves, we're interesting, you know. We should know more about ourselves and about other people. And having kinds of historic sites and sacred sites and destinations, they can fit in to economic plans for tourism and so forth, of making us a more sensitive society on dealing with diversity, which is increasing.
What do you see the benefit of diversity?
I think we need to understand other cultures, and I think we need to understand ourselves. We need to understand the degree to which we are products of the past. Your ancestors and mine came from Europe. We need to understand that heritage. By the same token, those of us whose people came from other places ought to respect the indigenous people here, thousands of years before we were.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Radio. And we just heard from David Gradwall, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology and Founding Director of ISU Archaeological Lab. Sebastian Brown, Director of American Indian Studies at ISU, offers more insight on sacred sites and indigenous religion. He also talks from the perspective as a previous resident of North Dakota and Department Chair of American Indian Studies at the University of North Dakota.
A sacred site is any site that is culturally significant in a religious way, I would say. And that can be anything. It can be something that is very visible, or it can just be a location that is meaningful, powerful, in a way, people. These sites existed long before the land was cut up into these artificial boundaries that we now have put on the land, right? They exist far away from today's reservations because people, of course, lived in many places before reservations were established. The notion that tribal sacred sites, that is, that sites that are of religious significance to tribal religions, are something worthy of protection, is one that is pretty recent if you look at American history. The notion that we can't just go and dig up native bones, native cemeteries, that we can't just go and loot, basically, native archaeological sites is one that is pretty recent, was put into law beginning in the 1970s, maybe. So, you know, within my lifetime, it was just land that you know, it was things that you took. They were in the land, right? I mean, American Indians were often included within wilderness and naturalness, right? American Indians were part of nature. And so if you find something that's part of nature, then it's yours, right? Just like if you find a special rock on a piece of land, well, that's a rock. That's nothing
else.
They
were part
of
the land.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's connected to this view of American Indians as primitive, as savages, as uncivilized, as not having done anything with the land, right? As hunters and gatherers who just live on the land but never didn't really own it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just moved on the land, just followed the buffalo, everybody lived in teepees, right? They didn't have real houses, which is completely, completely wrong. This idea has been around for a long time and is still around with many people. The other thing that comes into it is that there's this idea that American Indian religions are not really religions. That real religion is Well, first of all, Christianity, and second, maybe some other organized religions with a written, you know, with written dogmas, and a church or a temple or a mosque or something that is tangible, that stands. And that site then is the sacred site. And the idea that you have a religion where you go out in nature, where certain places are sacred, because they're powerful, and you have to leave them alone so that they can keep their power, or so you can go there and pray, and your prayer has power. This idea is something that doesn't really mesh with many people's experience of religion. And so I think all these ideas come together, and especially if you deal with engineers or, you know, people who put a lot of emphasis on technological progress and on economic progress, on capturing value in the land, those ideas don't really mesh with mm-hmm. the values that the indigenous peoples might have. Yeah, so in the 1970s, there was the American Indian Religious Freedom Act passed, and that basically it did many things, but it basically said if you build a project and it affects native religious sites, you have to treat these native religious sites the same way as you would treat non-native religious sites. And the test case for that came in California, where the National Forest Service wanted to build a road through a national forest. And that site, that area, was sacred to local tribes. And in that case, the Supreme Court of the United States decided that basically economic development has primacy over religious sites. So although they acknowledged that basically that these tribal religions would no longer be able to be practiced, the road could be built because it would provide economic development to the surrounding communities.
The struggle at Standing Rock is known for being conducted in conjunction with prayer and spirituality, and the fight about the water has become symbolic as well as practical.
Actually, as far as I understand it, the dispute on the core land is not so much about sacred sites. The great concern by the tribe is that the Missouri River, that is Lake Oahe now, is the only source of the drinking water for the reservation. And so if the pipeline is built 500 yards, you know, north of the reservation, that if this would spill, that there wouldn't be time to do anything about it before the oil or whatever else leaks reaches the water intake. And then it would be in the drinking water. And that would be devastating.
And just to be clear, the lakes are basically sections of the river that have been dammed up.
Is that
correct?
So Lake Oahe is the Missouri River that was dammed at the Oahe Dam, which is right north. It is important because Lake Oahe and these other dams along the mainstream of the Missouri River absolutely devastated native economies along those reservations because they flooded the best agricultural lands. They flooded the only land where there was timber, and most people lived along the Missouri River, so they all had to relocate. And it absolutely devastated Cheyenne River, Standing Rock, Fort Berthold especially. These reservations basically fell from pretty much self-sustaining ranching and agricultural economies into economies of unemployment after that.
Because of the relocation.
Yeah. I would say when you deal with drinking water, this is a concern that is not just made up. There is the real potential here that the water intake could be polluted.
Based on what you said, they have a concrete reason.
Right. I do see a little bit of a difference between what the tribe is saying and what some of the water protectors are saying, right? For the tribe, this is, right, a very practical concern. If you don't have drinking water that is pure, that is good to drink, then what are you going to do? For some of the water protectors, it is, I think, more than that. It is also a philosophical or religious concern.
Symbolic.
That water is sacred, right? Mm-hmm. For the tribe, I think the practical concern probably ranks higher, uh-huh. you know, for most people than the philosophical concern.
So they have a real reason why they're concerned about this particular...
Right, exactly. And so the tribe basically wants the pipeline to be rerouted at least. Some mm-hmm. of the water protectors want the pipeline not to exist. Right.
Sebastian Braun, Director of American Indian Studies at ISU. You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we have been hearing various unique approaches from people in our community who can offer insight into the Bakken Pipeline, part of our community's story. Earlier, we heard from David Gradwall, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology and Founding Director of ISU Archaeological Lab, Nitin Gadya, a mapmaker who lives in Ames, Yvonne Scott, resident of North Carolina who is traveling in the Midwest along the pipeline route, Leda Burton, mayor of Pilot Mound, and Jeff Lass, a resident of Pilot Mound, Iowa. I have been one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen.
And I've been your other host, Ursula Rudenberg. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Remember that KHOI is archived at khoifm.org, khoifm.org. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. You can also listen to it online at khoifm.org and find links to information about the people we spoke to today. Remember, you are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Please become a member sponsor by going to khoifm.org and donate there. Thank you for listening, and we will see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.
Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting the Nutcracker Ballet on Saturday, December 10th and Sunday, December 11th. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.